And a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you. It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. If you have questions, you can email me with your questions. It's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100. And it was kind of a crazy week last week until Wednesday. That was what we call House of Origin cutoff when we stopped debating bills. But up until that point, it was pretty wild, especially for the House. So we'll start with the representatives. And the Parents' Bill of Rights, well, I'm going to call it the bill that dismantled the Parents' Bill of Rights, but made changes to the Parents' Bill of Rights, passed off the House floor after lengthy debate, to say the least. I mean, it was another one of those early morning, 2:30 in the morning. So talk a little bit about that bill, the debate, and, you know, what it does. And then, Senator Shore, you can pick it up from there because it's coming over to the Senate.
Yeah, I had to smile when you said it was a busy week up through Wednesday. I was going to say it was a busy week until about 3 in the morning on Thursday morning. And then actually the rest of Thursday and Friday were busy in committees. But very, very busy the first part of the week. You're exactly right. So the bill to gut the Parents' Bill of Rights was brought forward as the last bill for the Democrats prior to the House of Origin cutoff. We started debating around kind of early evening, and it went until very, very early in the morning. We brought dozens of amendments, and just as a bit of background, so what the underlying bill does is it was an initiative I-2081, where it created a series of protections for both public school students and parents of public school students. And the majority of Democrats made very clear that it was a priority for them to largely gut Initiative 2081. That was what we were debating the other night. We brought dozens of amendments. Some were taken, which was amazing. I think they were just viewed as politically too toxic not to accept. But it, even with that, it was still a bad bill. I enthusiastically voted against it and ended up passing out of the House.
Yeah, I also voted against it, spoke against it. It was, it's honestly at this point a little bit complicated as far as what it does and doesn't do. They, like Representative Abel said, they took several of our amendments, as well as they had a striker that changed some of the, they had some of their own amendments. And so I think this week I need to spend some time really digging into what exactly the bill does. And the Senate also passed a version of this as well. But anything that undermines parents' rights is a concern to me. And it also is concerning that they put an emergency clause on, which makes it so that it's difficult to send it to the people for a vote through a referendum process. So there's a lot to be concerned about that bill and many others.
Well, one of the things I talked about on closing was that, you know, many of our rural, small, you know, school districts in the 7th, there's an extremely strong bond between the community and the school district. But what I am seeing increasingly in recent years is, you know, just speaking of my own school in Ichilium, attendance is on the decline, primarily because parents are homeschooling their kids or sending them to a private, one or more, you know, private academies. And it's because of concerns which underlie, you know, Initiative 2081. People are really concerned about the health and strength of our public schools and what's being taught in them. And without the protections of Initiative 2081, I'm concerned that trend is going to continue. So that's something I talked about when I voted against it.
Well, and then, too, just adding on to that a little bit more, is that we have this trust crisis in our state. I know we've talked about that before. And when you have trust in our schools being eroded, that's even worse when you're talking about our kids. And when you pass highly partisan bills affecting parents' relationships with the schools and the children's relationship in the schools and with each other, it just further erodes that trust, and it's something we really need to work on. Getting back to anything related to our kids really should be bipartisan.
And Senator Short, Representative Abel mentioned this. A similar bill left the Senate and is headed to the House. So at some point, if Democrats, you know, are continuing to move this legislation forward, those two bills will have to be, you know, I guess, reconciled, merged in some way. But what did the bill that left the Senate do? And you, have you had a chance to look at the House legislation yet to see how they differ?
No, I have
not. Sorry, Senator, your microphone is not on. Oh, there you go. You didn't have your microphone.
Sorry about that. Monday morning. Oh, boy, already. No, so the bill that left the Senate was essentially the same bill until they did adopt amendments. I think they might have done that for some of their vulnerable senators, where we put the timelines back for parent notification. But the big one that didn't change was parents' access to medical and health records. We clearly know that the initiative that we passed last year met federal and state law. So this was clearly something that was done to undermine parents' ability to get the kind of records that really as fundamentally should have. And so that's a bill that went to the House for consideration. I'd actually be surprised if they do anything with it. I think it seems like the House vehicle has potentially more momentum to get through, but I think the Democrats will be ironing that out. But again, we fought tirelessly on the floor as well, just reiterating the state getting in the middle, really in the way of parents' rights with their children. And it's really abominable when you think about it. You know, we are entrusted as parents with our children to go through the good times, the challenging times, and everything else in between to help just do this amazing job of just such an honor to help our kids, you know, go through all the stages of their life and into adulthood. And the state lands right in the middle of that. And they shouldn't at all.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important to maybe define where Republicans are on this compared to where Democrats are. Because if we talk a lot about, you know, these bills and what they do and what they don't do. But just overall, I guess, what are the biggest differences between the way Democrats approach this and the way Republicans approach this?
Well, I think Republicans approach it as something that you go through your life with your child. And look, there are challenging times when, you know, kids don't know who they are and they challenge, you know, parental authority, all of those kinds of things. Those are the ebbs and flow of parenting. The Democrats would really have you think that, boy, by the age of 13, you're on your own. I mean, that's essentially what Senator Peterson said in an interview on Fox News, which, by the way, he says was taken out of context. But when you look at the transcript, it really wasn't. And I think when I think of children who are in danger or children who are in circumstances where parents aren't doing right by them and are creating endangered situations, the laws are very clear on that. The state can step in and does and should if children are in, you know, an environment that incredibly with drugs or just not parenting, right? Like not taking care of your kids. And there are clear laws, defined laws, that protect kids in that instance. But the state, the Democrats would just say the state has complete authority over your children. And that is just such a, gosh, that's not even close. So we'll see how we will continue to fight for parents' rights in the lives of their children. We'll continue to fight for you know, school districts that have that local autonomy, that they have their elected school boards be able to make those decisions best for the students and families in their communities. Right now, that very clearly isn't the case.
So I'll jump in and go even a little bit, maybe one step further, and just say I think the difference between the parties on this issue is really stark. You know, Republicans send our kids to public schools hoping they'll, you know, learn the three R's, the reading, writing, and arithmetic, you know, be ready and able and prepared to go out and succeed in the world and hopefully be in an environment that, if not is supportive of the values at home, at least is not antithetical to it. Whereas the Democrats have a very different perspective. Their perspective is once the kid is in public school, that the public school system has a right that's superior in many ways to the parents as far as how to raise the children. And that's, I don't think that's an overstatement. It's really, really disconcerting and a strong point of contention between the parties.
Anything to add on that, Representative Mangle?
Well, just that I would echo what they say. Well, I should also add, my children are homeschooled. And I was homeschooled. And so I haven't got a lot of experience in the public school system other than through work. And sitting through the Parents' Bill of Rights 6-hour debate the other night makes me extra glad that I made the choice I did. But I know that a lot of parents don't have that option. And so it's imperative that we as Republican legislators stand up for the rights of people who still need to send their children to public school. And, you know, we heard an incredible amount of testimony from our members about their own children's experiences in school over the last few years, which was surprising and shocking to me how many of them, let's just say, had experiences with their children either being bullied or having to compete or even being injured in sports with girls and boys, biological boys and girls, competing against each other, showering together. It was just a staggering amount of concern there, and we really need to do something about this to protect those children.
Is part of the problem to this kind of east-west divide situation, I mean, people who live in the Seattle area may view this entirely different than people who live in, OMAC, right? Is that part of the challenge that you, because, I mean, we are one state, and so, you know, you make laws for the entire state, right? But, I mean, people can have completely different points of view, and not just, you know, east-west, but, you know, maybe rural-urban, right? I mean, how big of a challenge is that overall, I guess, in crafting legislation? I mean, Democrats, do they consider that at all in your experience? When you talk with them, you say, hey, listen, people I represent are just completely... think about this completely differently than the people you represent.
Well, so those conversations do take place. That, in fact, I know Representative Engel and I have talked about that a lot, that part of our job is to just educate the rest of the members in the House about how different our district is, and I know Senator Short does that as well in the Senate. You know, what I see is, it frankly, it varies from legislator to legislator and issue to issue. In some issues, you know, they're willing to have that conversation. On a lot of issues, you know, my perception is that there's a strong undercurrent of, well, we know what's best.
Right, right.
You know, you bumpkins, you know, out in the sticks, you know, are not up to speed with what we should be doing statewide. You know, so you'll catch up eventually once we drag you there. And, you know, part of my job is saying, you know, we think we've got a better solution, you know, certainly for my district and frankly statewide, because we do deal with state laws. And so that's a lot of the conversations I end up engaging in.
And I would echo that, too. So we do have a problem between east-west, rural-urban. The problem is, like Representative Abel said, is that they commonly believe that they do know what's best. And that they want, I think if you talk about this philosophy of the state knows what's best and they want this uniformity, honestly, they'd like it across the world. But they'll start with wherever they got influence, so it's across the state in this case. I believe that we need to go back to empowering our school boards to make the decisions for what's best for the children in their own district. And it's okay if you have a variety of styles and you're tailoring your school system to meet the needs of those parents and students in each region. So I believe that the state legislature has a role to play, but largely its role should be to re-empower the school boards to do what's right.
Well, and you think about, in our state, we have 295 individual school districts. And I talk about that a lot because I think what it really says is exactly what Representative Engel said. It's designed for schools to be able to meet the needs of those closest to them, right, in the education of the students and in their communities. And really what it is it's like there's no tolerance for a difference of opinion or a difference of how you might solve a problem. And what it really fundamentally does, the default position is that schools aren't doing right by kids or the superintendents or the principals or the teachers, you know, it because it doesn't look the same, you know, how they might, you know, help a child in distress, right, may be handled differently, or, and all of a sudden it's like, well, you didn't do it this way, and so therefore it's got to be wrong, and it's really casting aspersions in a real, you know, in a default way, because as to Rep. Engel's point, you're not, you know, it's not uniform. You're not doing it all entirely the same way. We had a bill in the waning days of the floor action that frankly weaponizes OSPI to go over school. And sorry, guys, you're going to see this bill. We were not able to stop it, to go after schools and officials who don't comply with legislative mandates. And it really sets up a very broad, you know, system where complaints could be made and OSPI takes it from there. Instead of allowing a state law to say, look, you know, the school needs flexibility in how they design, you know, design their policies to meet the state law, right? That's the way it's always been, but increasingly it's less and less. And that gets back to really forcing a uniformity of standard, which goes completely against the 295 individual school districts that we have and the communities who are part of them. And I think what, you know, we have a lot of discussion about education funding in the legislature. We had bills to do a variety of things. Obviously, special ed's really important, but we also had bills to take the bond, you know, the bond vote down to 50% or 51% or 55. But I would argue, and really I think we're seeing that, is that the more they push these one-size-fits-all policies and really start fracturing, it fractures community support for our schools when maybe a retired person who doesn't have, you know, kids in the school system would still support a bond or they'd still support a levy because, you know, our schools are integral to our communities. And what we're seeing is it's really creating division in a way that's harming support for our local schools.
This is Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. If you have a question, you can email me directly, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. It is St. Patrick's Day, and I will say, I can't see the senator, but both representatives did wear green ties today, so they are representing, so to speak. Senator Short, did you get your green on? I can't.
Yes, I have a green blazer jacket on.
Okay. Good deal. All right. Well, beyond that, another, what I'm sure you consider a bad bill that came out of the House and is headed to the Senate is rent control. We've talked some about this, but that was another long debate on that one. What does that bill do? And Senator Short, I guess, after the representatives talk about what it does and how the process in the House, maybe you could talk about what its chances are in the Senate. So why don't we start with you, Representative Engel, because I know this is something that you follow very closely as you yourself have rental units in low-income rental units. So talk a little bit about what this bill does and why you are opposing it.
Yeah, so rent control is a major concern, honestly, because I believe it's going to ultimately harm tenants. What its fundamental piece is that people hear about is it caps rent increases to 7% per year, which I understand. You know, we have a lot of people who've had dramatic rent increases. Probably most people, including myself, have family and friends who've had 30-40% rent increase notices where you've got a matter of weeks to prepare to either move or pay a significantly higher rent, and that can be devastating to families. And that's really what I think is driving this discussion. The challenge is that when the government gets in the mix, it often doesn't work well. We really need more housing constructed. unfortunately, we are doing all these things that are making it harder, especially in rural areas, to construct the housing we needed through increased regulations, the cost. We've added tens of thousands of dollars per unit in new regulations just over the last few years. And so we're not seeing the construction in rural areas that we need, or in the cities either, but that's for another legislator. So there's a number of things in the bill that are concerning that are beyond just the 7% cap. We were able to negotiate some of those things, and I'm honestly not 100% sure what's left and what's gone. But there was things like a 1.5% cap on late fees, which for my lower income rentals would be about $6 or $7 for a late fee, which really isn't enough to be the teeth that you need to encourage people to pay their rent on time. I very rarely actually collect a rent late fee, but I will utilize it as an opportunity to say, call me. People call me, say, I've had some challenges this month, and I'll say, if you can pay me $100 now and the rest on the 15th, I'll waive the late fee. If the late fee is $6, then I don't think that's very much of an incentive. It also has a cap on move-in expenses, which I believe got negotiated out of the bill, so that's good. And it sounds good, right? It's obviously expensive to go to move into a rental if you got to come up with $4,000 or $5,000. But on the other side of that is what I see a lot of my tenants coming to me who have been told they are not even eligible to apply for a lot of other rentals because they don't have a good enough credit. They got something in their background. They've got pets. And so sometimes an increased rental deposit is a way that you can mitigate some risk for the landlords. Without that, a lot of landlords are simply going to say, no, you're not eligible to rent at all, which is going to force, unfortunately, some of these people to the streets. Also, like some of the bill should have, if you're going to talk about a rent control, we really should have had an option to increase the amount of rent increases larger for those under market units. I talked on the floor about my cheapest unit, which is $450, which would be a $31 per year increase is all I could get. You know, that's probably an $800 unit, it should be. But, you know, the tenant living there has some health issues, had some financial issues. I just haven't had the heart to raise the rent. But now I won't be able to. And so it could be 20 or 30 years, and they'll still be under market, which leaves no incentive for them to ever leave and really makes it difficult for me to put the money into the unit that it needs for proper maintenance. So I believe what we'll see is some of those types of places will become more and more dilapidated. We'll end up with tenants not getting taken care of the way they should. There'll be a lot of unintended consequences with this bill. So I know I'm kind of talking a long time about this, but this is a major concern.
Well, and Representative Engel's subject matter expertise on this was absolutely invaluable, both in our internal discussions and out on the floor. You know, what we heard was a lot of, you know, emotion, you know, behind the bill saying, gosh, you know, we can't find, you know, rental units, and this is a real problem. And Representative Engel's real-world experience running, you know, these rental properties was really helpful in just saying, here's how it's going to work in the real world. So that was tremendously value-added.
Is this something, Senator Short, that you think Republicans could defeat when it comes over to the Senate, or do you think it's a foregone conclusion that this is going to move forward?
No, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. You know, certainly our numbers in the Senate, you know, in terms of Democrat-Republican numbers are challenging. But I can say that from the start of session, you know, all of us have been working to have conversations with other members about the unintended consequences that have been discussed, even though, you know, the idea of capping rent just sounds like, hey, this should take care of all of the problems, and we know that it doesn't. And so I think this is one that'll be one of those bills at the last minute is either going to go or it's not. But I can tell you just we work and started from day one working tirelessly to try to stop bad bills. Obviously, we want to advance good legislation as well, and there's some of that. But there have been a litany of bad bills that, you know, that have been introduced this session. And just like the rent control bill, along with dozens and dozens of others, you know, our work has been how can we create partnerships with the other side to be able to see that these bills do, you know, do not advance during session. Our topic is that the bills are killed. That's kind of how we discuss those simply. But I've got over two pages of bills that in one way or another, Senate Republicans have ensured have not gone forward. And I'm really proud of that. You know, from the bill dubbed the initiative killer, the bill that would have, you know, put onerous requirements on signature gatherers and fines, really, we feel, to really ensure that, heaven forbid, that you know, Washingtonians might disagree with the way the legislature is doing their job on policy and really interrupt and thwart the ability of people to take it on through initiative. We've had a number of soft on crime bills that we're super proud have not gone forward. Democrats seem to support more of the criminals getting leniency than actually support for the victims. We've had a number of other bills that, you know, again, just really are things that are the antithesis of, you know, just freedom, of individuality, of, you know, just our ability to use our property, and just, you know, the list goes on. The one I'm most proud of that I had a hand in was the bill that would have overregulated, you know, wood and pellet stoves. We know our district uses wood stoves and pellet stoves to heat their homes. It's a very measured way, less expensive and available. And so I was super happy that bill is not going forward.
It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. When we get back, we'd love to tackle some of your questions. You can email me, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. We'll be right back.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
It's what we were taught, trained, and told to do.
It could be for anything. Helping a friend move.
Listening to a fellow veteran for hours, at any hour of the day.
Or just simply making time for people. A neighbor, a loved one, or even a stranger.
We're often the first to help others. There's no question about it.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
Perhaps it's time to do for yourself what you would do for others.
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
What are you doing out there?
Come on!
I saw you at the game the other night. Yeah, you.
up there getting mad, acting like we're all out there making a million a game. But let me be real with you. This isn't the pros. It's school sports, and it's a game, our game. So please, let us play.
School sports fans, remember, when you cheer for your team, make noise for the right reasons. This message presented by the NFHS and the NIAAA.
And all student athletes in Washington.
And welcome back to Live from Olympia on this St. Patrick's Day. We have with us 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. And, boy, there are just so many bad bills that left the House and came over the Senate, and the same is true in the Senate. There were some good bills, too, and we'll get to those in just a sec. But now we're starting to switch gears a little bit here in the legislature. There's a lot more talk about the budget. And Senate Republican Senator Short actually put out their own budget. And lo and behold, they figured out a way, or you all figured out a way, to balance the budget. It's like you would think the Democrats would just take this and say, let's do this, because it doesn't raise any taxes, doesn't raise any fees, doesn't make any significant cuts, funds everything that's funded right now, and kumbaya. Talk about the Senate budget and why it seems to be a non-starter with Democrats.
Well, first of all, I'm really proud of the senators from the Republican senators who worked on a bill. What I will say is it is a real bill, not just ideas about, you know, what you might do. It's over 1,000 pages. The numbers have been put together by nonpartisan staff. And so this is indeed something that could definitely be put forward. We're hoping that our bill will change the conversation. We showed that you can do the important work, the fundamental work of the state, you know, adding funding to education, preserving and maintaining services for Washington's most vulnerable residents, making smart investment in public safety, and demanding accountability. Those are all the things, frankly, that Governor Ferguson talked about. And this is a budget that we've shown that it can be done, and frankly, is a budget that can be adopted. Will the Democrats, you know, adopt it? Maybe there are pieces and parts that they might, but frankly, they are bent on raising taxes and fees. Oh my gosh, the fee bills that we have seen, and unfortunately will continue to see, hunting and fishing licenses, increasing those, increasing fees for individuals who have, you know, gravel pits that, by the way, affects individual businesses, also affects local governments as well. Just substantial fee increases every time you turn around. And look, there are some where industries will come forward and say, you know, we really need this work to be done. We'll support an increase. But I am incredibly, you know, proud of the effort we've made to show that this can be done and to do it in a way that does not minimize the things that we need to do in the state of Washington. It's very pragmatic. I really hope they take a serious look at it. But look, we're in a time of session where the budget is going to take center stage even more than it already has. We've got a revenue forecast coming out this week that will show, is the revenue coming into the state of Washington on track? Or are we going to have to adjust, you know, where we go? But the thing I'm most proud about is it doesn't burden Washingtonians. It does it in a way that respects both the things we need to do as a state, but does not burden individuals and families and businesses. And I just think it's the right approach.
We should set the stage a little bit here. I guess I've done this beforehand, but what we're dealing with here in the legislature this year is a $6.6 billion budget shortfall. And when I say the Senate Republican budget balances that, it makes up for the short, because one thing you need to keep in mind is the state is bringing in more money than it's ever brought in before. So it's bringing in record revenues, but
it's spending more.
Right,
than, it's spending
right.
more than we're taking in.
Right.
That's the reason we're in the situation we're in.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's a good point. And what Senator John Braun, who's the Senate Republican leader, said to me over the weekend, he said, not only do Democrats want to raise taxes to fill this hole, the $6.7 billion, but they want to continue spending, and spending more than ever before. And so to do that, you have to get more revenue, and that raises taxes, basically. So I know, Representative Abell, you're working on this in the House. What's the mood over there on the budget, and what are you hearing? What do you think is going to happen on the House side?
Yeah, the dynamics are really fascinating over on the House side. So, of course, we've got the Senate, you know, working, doing what they're doing with Senate Republicans, issuing their proposed budget. We've got a new governor over here who, in his inaugural, said he wanted to look for efficiencies and savings in the budget before looking at any sort of tax increases. But on the House side, the House Democratic leadership appears to be still interested in trying to go down this tax-raising, hole that I would very strongly oppose. I know Representative Engel would very strongly oppose. And so, you know, the dynamics between the House Democrat leadership and the governor, I think, are fascinating. I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but my guess is that there's been some pretty strong communications behind the scenes.
It seems like there's been a bit of a strained relationship there.
I think that's true. Again, from, you know, a little bit of an outsider's perspective. But, you know, the governor said, we need to have an honest conversation about how we got to this point. And I think there were a lot of House Democrat leaders who didn't like hearing that. I mean, frankly, they're kind of, in my mind, kind of the architects in many ways of how we got here. I mean, Senate Democrats as well. But my sense is that there are some kind of strained relations there, and we'll see what it looks like in the final product. But, you know, if we've got a governor who is walking the walk and saying that we have to have a real serious conversation about how we got to this point, that's refreshing, because we've been saying that for some time.
I heard a Senate Republican say on Friday, we'll have to see if his pen is where his mouth is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if a budget, I mean, from what we're hearing, and you guys are on the floor, you guys know what's going on, but the Democrats are going to move forward with a budget that raises revenue, that raises taxes. And, I mean, is there any indication that that's not the case, Senator Schor? I mean, everything I've heard is that it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to do this. They're going to raise some of these taxes. I mean, do you think that the governor would veto a Democrat budget?
Boy, I don't know. That's that is the ultimate question. And I do think they are bent on doing this. Look, I do know that there's been work to look at every program. You know, our Senate Republicans have been involved in that process with Senate Democrats, and we're certainly appreciative of that. But at the end of the day, I think you said it earlier, they want to continue to spend more instead of looking, you know, at whether the state should do things. Is it really the state's obligation to do whatever that is? And I think in the Democrats' mind, it's really there's never enough. There's never enough money. There's never enough reason to pass, onerous laws on the people of the state of Washington. And again, it's just a real control piece is what it is. They want the state regulating every facet of Washingtonians' lives. And that ends up getting very expensive instead of really targeting those fundamental things that states should do, because families can't do them or communities or local governments can't do them. And it's really the state's role. And there are those things, absolutely. But there's so much that the state's doing that it shouldn't. And it all comes with a price tag. And so I think at the end of the day, yes, they're going to raise taxes. Don't know which ones. Is it going to be vacation rentals? Is it going to be, you know, our storage units? Is it going to be giving local governments the ability to do 3% instead of the 1%? Don't know what bills they're going to bring forward to do that, but they will raise taxes, no question. And I don't know about the governor. I think at the end of the day, it's put a lot on his plate, and I hope he's serious about it, but I'm not sure whether he's going to do that.
Question here from Andrea. She says, what can we do to support them with the budget? I think she's saying, what can citizens do to support you when it comes to this sort of thing? There are things you could do, right? I mean, you know, the biggest thing is reach out. Testify. You've talked before about how powerful it is. Andrew, we don't know if you could come all the way here to Olympia to testify on a budget bill, but, you know, you could do it remotely. Get involved that way, right? Isn't that a good way to help?
Yeah, that's a great way to help. I mean, so certainly testifying remotely or in person is wonderful. You know, something else that is meaningful is the letter to the editor or the opinion piece in the local newspaper, working with advocacy groups around the state to try and ensure we end up with a budget that helps us live within our means. All those things are very helpful. One thing I will also say, just from my own perspective, I suspect Representative Engel and Senator Shortfield the same way, but it's really encouraging to us when we hear from folks back home, just encouraging us in this fight, because it is a fight. It's a day in, day out fight. And the battleground is, you know, one of ideological warfare. What is the proper role of the state? We think the state is doing far too much. And our current budget reflects that. And certainly it seems that the budget that the other side is trying to put together just doubles down on that failed policy.
I want to jump into about hearing from people is really meaningful. And I think sometimes people wonder if anybody sees these. Obviously, there's some of these bills that we receive hundreds and hundreds of emails about, which is great. And it's a talking point we can use. A lot of bills we don't really hear from anybody. I will say, you know, the last couple of weeks during voting time, there was a number of these bills I'm researching that didn't go through one of my committees, and I'll search my email for the bill number and find that zero things come up. And so it is helpful. I think sometimes they, you know, people get overwhelmed. You know, when you've got a couple thousand bills to pick from, it's hard to track those. But it's important to know, I think, what's on the table here. You know, we have tax increases about creating a wealth tax. We have a 10 to 20% increase in B&O tax and tripling the amount of property tax growth, 11% tax on firearms. One of the other moves is to allow local governments, give them more taxing authority so they can encourage the local governments to raise taxes and then take money away from them. So they're basically forced to
raise
taxes.
Right. So you basically, the state mandates things that cost the counties and cities money, so the counties and cities have to raise that money through taxes, and so you allow them to increase their property taxes by 3% a year instead of just the 1% that's currently allowed without the vote of the people.
Yeah, very concerning.
That's interesting.
Well, and then I think one of the biggest concerns we have is this road usage charge. It's a cost, you know, a tax per mile you drive on top of all the existing gas taxes you're paying. All these things are concerning. One of the other tactics we're seeing as we're going through the session that really is concerning to me is around health care. They continue to put more mandates on insurance to cover more things or, you know, less out-of-pocket costs, or they're going to cover, you know, more hormone therapy medications. And some of it's good stuff. But what they're doing is they're exempting the state insurance from it. So what they're saying is this would cost too much for the state to pay it for our own insurance that we pay for. So we'll exempt that and make all the private insurance pay for it, whether they can afford it or not. And I find that really concerning as well. It's kind of like a tax increase in some ways.
Well, because what ends up happening is the private insurance has to raise its rates. It's the only way it can pay for this. It also has to raise its rates to make up for so basically what the medical providers charge, they have to raise their rates to make up for what the state is not doing. And it just gets passed on to the private rate holders, right? Isn't it? I mean, isn't it just
exactly
the cost it's just passing on the cost to somebody else? Because, I mean, the cost is the cost, right? It's going to cost these hospitals, these medical providers, a certain amount to provide this care. Somebody's got to pay for it.
Exactly.
Well, and one bill, unfortunately, Andrew, you're going to see, and I can't remember the bill number at the moment, but it does that same thing. So if you're a local hospital, it exempts critical access hospitals, which is good on one hand, but it does that same kind of tactics with hospital services. And so what I've essentially, they take PEB and SEB, so basically the state-provided, you know, employee health plans, and they start, again, trying to save those costs in the state. They put it on to everybody else. And, you know, you look at our hospitals, number one, I've heard from our critical access hospitals that they want, our urban hospitals need to be financially sound as well, because they do work together. They work in tandem together. And so an assault on urban hospitals is an assault on our critical access facilities. But it really, you look at Medicaid reimbursements, you look at Medicare reimbursements, you look at charity care, and all of those things. And it's what we've all talked about earlier. Somebody's going to pay for it, and that's generally been the state plans and the private plans. Well, now the bill would take state plans completely out and leave it with just the private market. The state plans represent, I think it's in the neighborhood of 20 to 25%, which is huge. And so, unfortunately, that is a bill that is coming your way in healthcare.
I heard some people say we already have, in a sense, socialized medicine. I mean, really, the private employers are subsidizing the state right now. That's how it happens. I mean, Medicaid reimbursement is much lower, you know. So what the government pays healthcare providers is much less than what it takes to provide the care. They've got to make that up by overcharging people in the private insurance market, right? I mean,
that's right.
Anyway. We talk a lot about the bad things on this program, and you know, there have got to be some good bills that passed off the House floor and off the Senate floor and are moving forward, bills that you support. Representative Abel raised his hand. So, go ahead.
Yeah, excited here. I've got my hand in the air. So I passed my first bill.
Congratulations.
Out of the House. Yeah, it was House Bill 1541, and it looks at the membership of a committee. It's called the Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee, that advises the governor and our State Department of Veterans Affairs on all issues impacting veterans. They do great work, and this was a long overdue revision of how the committee operates and the composition of the committee. And I was proud to support it. It passed off the floor unanimously, and in talking about it, I talked about a veteran who was really meaningful to me. His name is Jim Judd. He lived in Chilliam. He's long since gone home, but he was a World War II veteran and a dear friend of the families. Some of my earliest memories are of Jim Judd and my grandpa walking up and down the Chilliam football sidelines during games. He was a wonderful mentor for me and certainly knew a lot about veterans issues, cared about veterans issues. So I've been informally calling it the Jim Judd Memorial Act of 2025,
nice.
Just to honor you know, one of our hometown heroes there. So very happy he got out of the House and now is headed over to the Senate.
Well, we have another one that passed was my Group B water system bill, which I've talked about in this program before. And so this is so that people with up to 9 homes that share a well could do so potentially without having to hire a satellite management agency, the contractor who works at Department of Health that often charges a lot of money and doesn't do very much for it. And so I was happy that that passed unanimously out of the House last week. And it's actually up for a hearing today at 1:30 in Senator Short's Ag Committee. And so that's exciting. But there are a number of other good bills that passed. One regarding a slight rollback of regulation on child care. There's one that regarded agriculture fuel exemptions to make it easier for farmers to get out of that Climate Commitment Act surcharge. One bill that would allow people to park on the street in front of their own driveways, which apparently the state was prohibiting before. And so this gives more parking options. I'm sure a lot of people were doing it anyways, but this just makes it legal. There was one bill around lot splitting to make it easier for people to subdivide property in the city, so it affects our district less, but it's still helpful. And then one that removes some barriers for 16 and 17-year-olds to get jobs. And there was a number of other ones, but those are some of the top ones that come to my mind.
Senator Short?
Well, I've got a couple of bills that I want to highlight that are now actually in the House Agriculture Committee. So Representative Engel sits on that committee. One is on the recognition of the deer and elk damage that our constituents are having as a result of exploding predator populations. But it really, what it would do is focus this reimbursement on our Frontier One counties, our smallest counties, and make sure that people, should they, you know, should landowners, crop, just our farmers and ranchers want to go ahead and submit for reimbursement, they can. It's really going to put a focus on funding. I will say that it does it in a way that doesn't impact the Skagit Valley. As you know, Skagit Valley's been kind of the epicenter for elk populations. The second bill is my DNR bill, which just really make sure that any surveyors that are doing work for the Department of Natural Resources are communicating at every step of the process with landowners to ensure that those boundary line surveys are accurate and that landowners know what the potential impacts might be. But there's a couple of bills that are alive in the process that we're hoping still continue, and that's Senator Braun's bill adding fentanyl to the child endangerment statute is still alive. And another one of his bills would actually start the career and technical education as early as the sixth grade, really just designed to have kids have fun with different, you know, different industries, right? They can experiment. They can try it and see if they like it, and just really give some additional opportunity for students earlier on. And one last one is, you think it'd be pretty basic, but Ecology right now does not do annual reporting of the state emissions data. You would think they would if we're regulating everybody underneath that or reducing emissions, but this is one that would require annual reporting of state emissions data, and that is actually still alive. So I'm glad about that.
Yeah, they do it every 2 years now for some reason. You would think that's something that the legislature would want to know, and people would want to know every year, right? Since we have this whole Climate Commitment Act that that's based on those.
Oh, it is. I mean,
on those, yeah, those figures, right?
The regulatory burden and the cost burden on, you know, I still think that one of the unintended consequences is going to be the reduction of manufacturing in the state of Washington. But at the very least, the regulatory agency should be required to annually report that data.
Any last words there, Representative Abel? We have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, just looking ahead to this week, got a couple of neat things happening. So one of the coolest things that the legislature does is we operate a PAGE program. And a PAGE program is where we send high school students here to the Capitol for a week to really learn about the legislative process. And they deliver messages back and forth. You know, they work throughout the week. They get paid a little bit of money. But it does wonderful work. Well, I've got my first couple of pages this week, which I'm excited about. We've got Raina Johnson and Kira Peterson coming in from the district, so excited that they'll be here this week. Tomorrow is the governor's prayer breakfast, so get a chance to, you know, say a word of prayer for the governor and our state leadership. And then one thing that is kind of interesting to me is that I didn't realize this until we got here, but we do a memorial for past legislators who have passed away. And they had a number of legislators who'd passed away where they wanted a sitting legislator to honor them. I think we just carry a candle. And so I requested somebody kind of as opposite from me as possible, preferably somebody, a Democrat, West Side, female. And it turns out I'll be honoring Representative Carolyn Powers, who passed away this year. She served 26 years on the Port Orchard City Council, and I think one or maybe one and a little bit more terms here in the state legislature. I think she was appointed and served one full term. But she was a Navy family, actually. So it turned out there was a bit of similarity there, and doing a little bit of digging into that. So big week here with those things going on.
Well, faith is very important to you, so you must find these things heartening, these the prayer breakfast, yeah, and the memorial, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. It's very encouraging. We've got a weekly legislative prayer fellowship among the legislators and the staffers who gather together. It's a little early on Tuesday mornings. I've made most of them. There's some I just haven't made. But no, it is encouraging.
Senator Short?
Well, I
30
also,
seconds.
I have three pages, Cora Collier, Isaac Chapman, and Josh Michaels. So looking forward to meeting them this week.
Okay. And we look forward to talking with all of you next week. And remember, you can always ask us a question, and we encourage that. We'd love to hear from you here on Live from Olympia with your 7th District legislators, State Senator Shelley Short and Representative Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Tracy Ellis with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. Have a great day.